Jennifer Hambrick, midday host of Classical 101, WOSU Public Media in Columbus. I'm speaking with pianist Daniel Vnukovsky. You have recently released the first of what will be a four-volume series of recordings of the complete piano works of Karl Rothaus. How did you come to discover Karl Rothaus's music and to develop an interest in it?
It was a very long process. I think 2014 to 2016, I went through a little bit of a dark period, like many concert pianists go through. I was shifting focus and going towards medical studies, actually. And at the same time, I had just recorded the works of a Holocaust survivor, Walter Arlen, between the years of 2012 and 13. He was an Austrian survivor who emigrated to Los Angeles, where he worked as a critic for the Los Angeles Times and kind of kept his music secret for nearly half a century. And at the age of mid-80s, he wanted to find a pianist to record his works. And long story short, we met each other, and the man literally changed my life. I was so hooked on the man, his story, and the music. It was like a frozen snapshot from that era. And it, in a way, kind of reflected my own family's dark history, where my grandparents were survivors. I then started diving deeper and deeper, and then a new museum was inaugurated in Vienna, precisely at the music school where so many of these composers had studied. They came up with an exhibition of their own on the topic of these composers. And the more I began to meet with the families, the remnants of these survivors, discovering sheet music that had not been published. And one thing led to another. And finally, I had discovered this Polish-Jewish composer born in Ternopil, which was Austrian in 1895 at the time he was born. It consistently shifted borders, became Polish in the interwar period. And this man was completely obscure to me, but the music resonated so strongly. It was dark, unsettling, and once again was like that frozen snapshot when just upon listening to a couple seconds, one is immediately transported to the alienation of a Jew in the Weimar Republic era, the impending doom, the hyperinflation. In an instant, one experiences a certain flashback. And I was hooked. It bit me like a bug.
Rothaus was, of course, Jewish and lived in Berlin for about 11 years until 1932, when, because of the rise of Nazism there, he fled Germany and eventually made his way to the United States in the late 1930s. His music was quite successful in Berlin, but at a certain point in time after he came to the United States, his music fell into oblivion, even during his lifetime, which was cut short by really an untimely death. What are the factors that you think contributed to his music's falling into oblivion?
There are many theories. One being that perhaps Rothaus was his own worst enemy, being very humble, not fighting to secure his music with the major orchestras in the States. When he had settled into a kind of quiet professorship at Queen's College, and it's an interesting feeling when one walks into Queen's College today, one sees two portraits, one of Aaron Copland and then right next to him, Karl Rothaus. And there's literally no other portrait on that big wall except those two major figures. And yet Aaron Copland, we hear his music all the time. It's programmed in seasons all throughout the country, whereas Karl Rothaus remains completely obscure. And I think the psychology going on in a man that had his roots in Germany, that is, even though he was born in Ternopil, he absorbed the rich Austro-German tradition of composing through Franz Schrecker, whom he was a star pupil of Franz Schrecker. And he had absorbed the rich tradition of Richard Strauss, of Mahler, of course. And this was infused in his music. And at the same time, what my CD tries to show is Karl Rothaus taking this rich tradition and trying to embark on his own unique musical language, a very dissonant, unsettling musical language, but distinctly his own. So he had forged his own path, and now living as a young 30-year-old in Berlin, he felt at home. He felt he was truly a German composer and had really propelled forward, writing a wonderful opera, a ballet, The Last Pierrot, of which I did a piano transcription in the CD. These are wonderful, wonderful works, and he had kind of reached a zenith at the Third Symphony, which is breathtaking, wonderful, complex, magnificent work. So to have all that rug just thrown out of one's carpet and then have to scramble to find a new home, I think that played such a role in his psyche at the time when he had finally landed on alien soil, a vast landscape with new traditions, new friends, everything new. And I think at that time when he was literally at the height of his powers, it just was too much for him to continue fighting for. And he had to really fight. I mean, he had a visa that expired in 6 months to tour the States. So he had those 6 months to try and land and secure some position to get his works performed. And he really fought. He really fought to have them performed, but nothing really stuck. There were a few performances in the States when he arrived, but nothing on a real grand scale. And I think after his visa expired, and just by luck, he got that professorship that gave him at least some kind of survival mechanism. I think he was just beat up by the tyranny of what had struck him. He's to this day very, very difficult to categorize, which also doesn't help our efforts in promoting, in promulgating the great music that he wrote, because it's no longer modern enough to be considered new music. And it's not traditional enough to fit into that cushy kind of festival scheme that everyone likes, you know, Mozart up to Rachmaninoff, that narrow range of music.
So even his own style is sort of musically homeless.
Yes, exactly, yeah. Exactly. And he was also very versatile. He could write exquisite film music. He could instill folk music, and he could just kind of change his compositional language as required based on the assignment, which again complicates the journey of trying to categorize him. And on top of all that, to this day, we can't really say he's an American composer. We can't really call him a German composer because of his background and the time he was there, although that's possibly a close description. But then also when he emigrated to the States, similar like other exiled composers, they all of a sudden want to return to their deepest kind of childhood roots. And once again, we see a revival of Polish themes, dance themes, the Krakowiak, mazurkas. Are a little strange because they're Polish dances embedded within a kind of German-Austrian expressionist harmonic scheme. So they're very strange pieces, but very interesting in a way.
Let's talk about some of Karl Rothaus's music on your recording. You referred there a moment ago to the genre versatility that he had, and of course you include his mazurkas on your recording. Could you give us a sense for the context from which some or all of the pieces on this recording came?
Every time I embed this music into my concert programs, the reactions from the public are often extraordinary. The intensity of the music creates quite a stir. But at the same time, this is not music made to make one feel good, essentially. Although I, as a pianist, love to perform it. I find it cathartic. I love the energy, the drive. It's dense, it's rich, it's complex. My goal in Volume 1 is to uncover or shed light on what had led him to become the foremost young composer of his generation in the late 20s in the Weimar Republic. so this is Karl Rathaus forging his way in a time of great turmoil. We just had World War One. We had the Treaty of Versailles, which made life very, very complex for Germans at the time. There was a lot of uncertainty, and we have a complex wandering throughout these works. And I think that really comes across in each of them very broadly.
Also on your recording are a couple of selections from Rathaus's ballet, The Last Pierrot, which holds a special place in Rathaus's career.
The Last Pierrot was one of those works that truly catapulted him to the forefront of composers of his generation. It was written in 1926. Erich Kleiber, the music director of the Staatsoper in Berlin, had conducted it and brought it into his season. It was an extraordinary success. I find it interesting because it's Rathaus, a very dark, intensive composer, taking on something of commedia dell'arte, which is comedic farce. And the two extremes, in a way, work together to create this true work of art. There are moments now, finally, in this work where the music just eases somewhat. He'll throw in like a C major chord just at the right strategic location to get a temporary moment of relief, which we don't have in the works that came before 1926, such as the Second Piano Sonata, which is extremely dissonant to the max. It's Rathaus saying, I have enough of tonality, I'm going berserk. I'm going to the extreme, I want to find my own language. Here, he eases up a little bit. He goes back to more classical forms. Even the setting is a kind of romantic landscape with Pierrot falling asleep, and a strange man, we don't know much about him, comes and tries to wake him up, and he suddenly starts dancing a sentimental waltz that's full of his yearning for Columbina. Plot, but it's put into the kind of context of the urban frenzy of Berlin. And we hear a factory, there are conveyor belts, he tries to find his Columbina within workers in a factory. And the work was so successful that Karl Rathaus himself had made these arrangements for solo piano to keep the momentum, the great success of the time, running. Many people wanted to play this work.
You've also included some selections of Rathaus's film music on this recording. He had a very important place in the history of film music. Could you talk about that and also about the particular selections of Rathaus's film music on your recording?
The first collaboration he had with the German Film Commission was with the German director, Fedor Otsep, and that was for The Murderer, Dmitry Karamazov. And apparently the music was so strong that the movie was made around the music. Not the other way around. When Korngold came to America and brought the lavish Hollywood sound, the music had amplified the visuals for great cinematic effect. So Rathaus, in effect, was a pioneer of the kind of Hollywood film developments that occurred later after Korngold's heyday, that is in the 50s, 60s, film noir, and then Bernard Herrmann, who had admired Rathaus's contributions, where film music now became an integral component of the cinematic effects.
How are people receiving this music and your performances of it so far?
I've already given master classes in New York at Queens College, and the students were amazed at how they had not heard about this music. Many are starting to incorporate it into their repertoire. So it's a very strong part of musical history that I think should come back to the fore. It's been lost for far too long.
Vnukovsky's most recent recording is Volume 1 of the Piano Works of Karl Rothaus. I'm Jennifer Hambrick, midday host of Classical 101, WOSU Public Media in Columbus.